Hello. In recent snippets, we have been talking about the stock market and why it is an enemy of capitalism and what needs to be done to correct it and have it be an enabler, a true enabler of capitalism, rather than this half good, half bad element in our economic system that creates long-term instability and also drains resources from true investment. And we were talking about Amazon and Bezos, and we were trying to illustrate how the stock market can create a set of circumstances where a person like Bezos can have a personal wealth of $200 billion in Amazon stock. And in fact, he has already sold off $27 billion in stock. In other words, money that's now cash, not stock, but actual cash that he can use. And those $27 billion are not coming from Amazon being productive and making more goods and services and making him wealthy because of its productivity. Amazon has never given out 1 cent of dividend. We mentioned in 27 years of existence and 24 years of public trading. So that's those $27 billion that Bezos has come from stock buyers, people buying the Amazon stock at these exorbitant prices, even though they are not getting a single dime from Amazon itself. So at the end of the day, the stock market creates this sinister transfer of wealth from less wealthy to more wealthy people, but not for any real economic reason. It's all based on the investment that people are making in the perception of a piece of paper or the perception of a company rather than the company itself. It is a very strange scenario. When you're buying a stock and from someone at a higher price than he or she paid for it, you're basically saying, I have an increased expectation on the on my perception of the company. And that's why I'm buying the stock. Because with Amazon, it's not that people are dying to get the stock because the stock is so productive and gives them so many dividends. Because it doesn't give you a nickel of dividends. So the only value that you have in the stock is that you are trusting that by the time you are willing to sell a stock, the perception of Amazon will have increased enough so that you'll be able to sell it at a higher price. It's an investment in the perception of the company, not an investment in the company per se. And we saw that the way to fix that is to have stocks have a fixed price. And I would recommend a fixed small price of $100. So it's a stock from any company, any publicly traded company would be tantamount to a $100 bill. And you can buy it for $100 and sell it for $100, no more, no less. So for example, if you have invested in a company, and by the way, that $100 would always go directly into the company. You would not be giving money, extra money to a stock trader, like what is happening with Bezos. The original Amazon stock, I think, was $10, and I could be wrong with that number, but it was a very low amount. And now it's trading, if I'm not mistaken, around $3,000 per stock. So when Bezos sells his Amazon stock, $2,990, let's say the difference between the original price and the current price, that is being paid to Bezos because out of that $3,000, only $10 are inside Amazon. The other $2,990 are being given away to Bezos. Under a different system, the Constitution would require, the American Constitution required that the stock be at a fixed price of $100. So when you buy the stock, you buy it from the company and you are giving the company the $100. And if you sell it off to someone else, that someone else gives you $100 and he now owns the stock. But even though the trade happened between the two of you, what actually happened is tantamount to you selling the stock back to the company. So the company gives you $100, and then that company then sells that stock that you returned to someone else, and they get $100 from that other person. So at the end of the day, the company stayed the same. They gave you $100, and then they got the $100 back from the other buyer. So the net result for them is zero, and you would get $100 more, but lose the stock. And the other fellow would lose $100 in cash, but gain the stock. So as you can see, when you sold it to him for $100, it was tantamount to him buying it from the company, you selling it back to the company, and then the company selling it to him. So the money, the $100, stays in the company, even though you're trading it to someone else, and you didn't give the other person any extra money. And so you can sell the stock because, let's say, you need the money to, for some personal emergency, you want to have liquidity, and you just can't have the money being invested in Amazon anymore or whatever company anymore. So you sell it off, and the other guy is happy to buy the stock from you because he believes in the company and he trusts that he will get dividends from that. From that company. So now that he owns the stock, he knows that at the end of the year he can expect a dividend. And we also mentioned that the Constitution has to require that publicly traded companies provide at least a certain percentage of dividends at the end of every year if they make a net profit after a certain number of years of losses, let's say, and then they finally make a profit and they make up for the losses, then they have to give all the stock owners a minimum percentage of dividends. So as to avoid things like what Amazon has done, that in a quarter of a century, it has yet to give its stock owners, shareholders, a single nickel from its supposedly incredible success, which is not that successful as you might think when you look at all the numbers in the long term. So we have a system with lower liquidity, but a system where we go back to the principle of true investment, and you still have a level of liquidity because you are free to sell the stock. It's just that you can only sell it at the same price. So it also forces people to think long term, and to think more closely about the companies that are that they're investing in, and that would mean that all the people on Wall Street who work in doing financial modeling, they would still have a job. They would still need. They would be even more needed than ever before, because now people will need to be 100 more certain that they are putting their money into a good company that will really produce dividends and profits, and because it's creating and producing wealth for the economy. So these financial modeling job positions would remain, and we would have people dedicated to investing instead of this crazy speculation game that we have in the stock market, where we create a sinister transfer of wealth. So we were talking about all those things, and so now going back to what we were saying regarding the Great Depression, factor in promoting the Great Depression after the stock market created the problem was the mismanagement of the money supply. And And the new American Constitution will have very specific things to rules on how to manage money supply in a very objective way, so that we can kind of get the Federal Reserve away from a lot of the crazy things that it does right now that are not necessary. And I think that they are being done. And I wouldn't say that it's necessarily out of malice, like as if to say that they're not doing these things because they are they have some evil plan in the back of their mind, some malicious purpose. Maybe they do, but it seems like much of what they do is born out of a wrong concept of the money supply. But if we can get that fixed and put it in the Constitution, then the Federal Reserve would have a much simpler job. And let's stop calling it the Federal Reserve. Let's call it the Central Bank. Alexander Hamilton was for having a national bank, and a lot of people were against it. And I know that most conservatives cringe at the thought of a national bank. The term is hideous to them. But it's ironic that they find it hideous, but we have a central bank already. It's called the Federal Reserve. So we would just stop with the nonsense of pretending we don't have a national bank. We have a national bank. We just simplify its role and limit it and make it much more objective and not so much dependent on personal opinions about how the economy should operate. And Also, we need to get the Federal Reserve out of the job of managing the economy. That's not what the Federal Reserve or the central bank is supposed to do. The central bank is supposed to control the money supply. That should be its role. And if it's done in an objective way, then it will do its thing, and then the economy will take care of itself. And if the money supply is taken care of, the economy will be fine, obviously assuming that people are being productive and that we have a society that's functioning properly. So let's talk a little bit about the money supply. The money supply is usually thought of as the money that has been printed. You know, the dollars that have been printed and the coins that have been created. So you think of the physical money as the money supply, but and I believe that's called M1, or I could be wrong on that, but that's just one level of the money supply. Then there's the other level, which I, if I'm not mistaken, is called the M2 level of money supply, which is actually the sum of all the deposits, you could say, that are in the country. That's a very, very rough and probably incorrect, technically incorrect definition, but it's more or less an approximation. So if you, let's say, add up what everybody has in the bank, in their bank balance, that total is more or less the M2 money supply. And you would say, well, shouldn't that be the same thing as the M1? In other words, whatever has been printed is what people have deposited in the bank. You can't deposit money if the money doesn't exist. Yes, but what happens, as we try to mention very briefly in the previous snippet, is that when people put in, let's say, $1,000 into the bank, then they open a bank account, they put $1,000 in there, and then let's say that they physically take 10 $100 bills, and they go to the bank and deposit it, they open the account, and lo and behold, now they have that balance. Now the bank is required to keep, most banks, at least in the US, it varies depending on the size of the bank. Smaller banks have a smaller percentage of a reserve requirement. Larger banks have a requirement of 10%. And that 10% means that they can lend out money from the money they receive through deposits, but they have to keep a reserve of 10% in case that people come and ask for their money. You know, they do a withdrawal and they want to get their money from an ATM or cash machine. So the bank is required to keep at least 10% of the deposits. That means that out of the $1,000 that this person gave to the bank as a deposit to open his account, the bank can take $900 and lend it to people. So give out loans up to $900, and $100 have to stay in the bank. So that's what that's the reserve fund, and that's what the Federal Reserve manages. Every bank has a bank account. It's like the Federal Reserve is the bank of banks, and every bank has a bank account in the Federal Reserve that is supposed to have this reserve. In other words, let's say that's the only, the $1,000 is the only money that bank has, which is silly, but just to give an example, then that bank will have $100 in its reserve account with the Federal Reserve, at least $100. Like, that's the money that the bank puts away as a reserve. So they go and deposit it in their bank account in the Federal Reserve, and it has to be at least 10% of the total deposits. So now that let's say that the bank gives out a loan of $900 out of that $1,000, they put $100 in their Federal Reserve account, and then they give out $900 in loans. So now somebody receives those $900 because they want to start a business. So now the first thing they do is, and now that they have this loan from Bank A, they go to their bank, Bank B, and deposit the $900. So now Bank B has an account of $900. And now they can put 81 of those dollars or 90 of those dollars in their Federal Reserve Bank. In other words, they have to set aside $90 as a reserve, and now they can lend out $810 to the next person. And then the next person comes, takes out a loan for $810, and then they deposit it in their own bank, Bank C. So now Bank C has a third bank account with $810. Now they can reserve 81, that's 10% of 810, and then they can loan out 729. So then the next guy who gets the 729 can open a bank account or put that money in their bank account and so forth. So as you can see, originally there's only $1,000 in actual money, but the $1,000 magically, you could say, became $1,900 with the first loan, and then $1,900 plus 810, $2,710 with the second loan, and so forth. So even though physically there's only $1,000 circulating, if you add up the bank accounts, the balances, you get more money, and that's how the money supply grows. So it grows through credit. And obviously, the first person who took out the $900, they will put in $900 and then withdraw money quickly to start using it up for their business. So obviously, it's not as simple as we just laid it out, because the money just doesn't stay in the bank account, in those bank accounts. It gets withdrawn. But more or less, you can see that there's a progression. An increase in the money that people perceive that they have available to use. So money supply is related to credit. And just as a side note, it's important to point out, and I think it should be written somewhere in the new American Constitution, about the importance of the banking system to capitalism. The banking system is what enabled the rise of our modern society, starting with the Italians during the Renaissance, that kind of kicked off the modern banking system. You know, the people in in Florence and Venice and Genoa, they started the modern banking system, even though banking has more or less existed for a long time in the Middle East, in Egypt, and even in China, there were kind of beginnings of a kind of a, what is similar to a modern banking system and so forth. But it was during the Renaissance in the, I think that was 1500s, when the Italians kind of kicked off the modern banking system, and it was the beginning of the rise of Western Europe. And what banking did is it democratized the economy by empowering people who were not landowners, and allowed them to accumulate resources and produce economies of scale. Because in the past, before the modern banking system, your wealth was more or less linked to the land. That's why the nobility were so powerful. They owned the land, and as such, they controlled the wealth. Because the more land you had, then the more crops you could grow, the more pigs and chickens and whatever you could grow, and that's how you measured your wealth. But slowly, as the economy, as technology came in, and people could produce more food without as much labor, where one person could produce the food for 5, 6, 7 different people, then those other other 5 and 6 people were now free to go do something else instead of just worrying about growing enough food to eat themselves, because someone was delegated to produce that food for them, and then they could go out and produce something else and pay the food grower with other stuff. So that was one factor, but the other factor was that when the banking system came in, then you didn't have to be wealthy. You didn't have to start off wealthy to become wealthy. Because that was the chicken and egg situation that you had in the Middle Ages, that you, if you were wealthy, then you had the land and you could continue being wealthy. And if you were poor, you didn't have the ownership of the land, and there was nothing you could do about it, so you would stay poor forever and ever. So you needed to have wealth to get wealth. And if you didn't have wealth to begin with, there was no way you could get the wealth. So there was this chicken and egg situation. When the banking system came in, then people who were not landowners could go and borrow money that they didn't have and use it, produce it, and then pay back. So it democratized the economy. And that's why I think sometimes we commit the sin of demonizing the banking system. When it really is something very central to the explosion of prosperity that we've had in especially in Western society over the last 400 or 500 years, and so the problem that we have is that because the banking system created this kind of invisible increase in the money supply, then we slowly allowed the banking system to have too much control over that money supply. And that's what the Constitution is going to change. It just so you know, just to give you a sense of the proportion of currency, actual currency versus the money supply, the virtual money supply that's out there. Right now, at the time of this recording, if I'm not mistaken, there are around $2 trillion physical dollars in circulation. $2 trillion. And that's kind of an interesting number when you think about it, because the current U.S. GDP stands at around $20 to $22 trillion a year. In other words, the U.S. economy is producing $20 trillion when it only has $2 trillion of printed money. So it's like the actual production, economic production, is 10 times the amount of physical money that's out there, which sounds odd. It doesn't seem to make much sense, but that's kind of the situation we're in. The problem with having this system that is where we basically increase the money supply through the reserve system of lending and keeping a reserve is that it kind of creates what I'd call a game of hot potatoes between banks and the Federal Reserve, and it leads to much economic activity that has no benefit. Because what happens is that banks by law are required, okay, I have to have 10% of reserves in my Federal Reserve bank account. You know, each bank is constantly saying that to itself. And I believe that check of the 10% is done every night. So at the end of every business day, your reserve account has to have at least 10% of your total deposits. And if you don't have that 10%, I don't know what happens. I don't know if the bank gets penalized. But the thing is, banks are very obsessed with keeping that minimum of 10%. And when they don't have enough to finish the day with 10% in their Federal Reserve account, what they do is that they go and borrow money from another bank. So they go to another bank that has excess reserves and says, hey, man, can you give us some extra cash because we are short. We need to have some money to meet the 10% minimum. And the other bank says, oh, okay, no problemo. I'll give you the money. But obviously it comes with a price. And that's what they call the federal fund rate, if I'm not mistaken. There's a technical term for that. The percentage that one bank charges another when it gives it a loan in reserves. So then the bank that needed the money gets the money from the other bank and puts it in their Federal Reserve account, and they meet the 10%, then they are saved for the day. And then eventually they have to pay that back to the other bigger bank that lent them the money. But this is what's happening every night between banks. Banks passing money back and forth between their Federal Reserve accounts just to keep the 10%. And it's like a game of hot potatoes. And what happens is that sometimes when, let's say that a bank is really desperate to give out this big loan, but they don't want to fall below the 10%, then they go get this money from, they're desperate to get this money from another bank. And the other bank realizes, oh, these guys really really need the money because they want to give out this big loan to this big customer. So the other bank will increase their interest rates, their federal fund rate. And when those rates start increasing, then economic activity slows down because now the banks are having more trouble lending money because they're constantly obligated to keep that 10%. So what the Federal Reserve does is that they have a target rate. They say, okay, we don't want the federal fund rate, in other words, the rate of interest that the banks charge each other, to get too high. So they have a target. We want the rate to be so-and-so. So when they see the rate going too high up, let's say above the target, they try to lower the target. They can't force the banks to lend at a certain rate because that'd be against the economy. They have to do it through open market operations. So sometimes what they do is they go and offer a direct loan. The Federal Reserve will lend the money to the bank directly instead of having to get it from another bank. And that's one way that they try to influence the rates that other banks provide or charge. And they also do it through the selling of government bonds and other crazy things. But it's this tango that the Federal Reserve and the banks are playing every night as we speak. You know, all these transactions of money that are going around, and to me, it or to anyone who observes this rationally, I would dare say it is like a game of short blanket, where there's this small, very small reserve supply of physical money, and people are, you know, they try to cover their feet, and when they try to cover their feet because the blanket is short, then they uncover their head. So they cover their feet for a second, and then they, then their head gets cold, so they try to cover their head, and then their foot gets uncovered, and it's so back and forth every night. Because these loans that are transacted between the banks and the Federal Reserve are always quick, short-term loans. They're not long-term, and they have to get paid back the money very quickly, and this just shuffling of money back and forth. And that is in great part because we are increasing the money supply in the wrong way, and we are keeping it artificially short. And many people would say, okay, we should go back to the gold standard. We shouldn't have this crazy, ambiguous system where the money, you know, can increase or decrease in value in these dramatic fluctuating ways. If we had the gold standard, then we could this dollar is backed by actual gold. But the problem with the gold standard, which is part of what led to the Great Depression, is that or prolonged the Great Depression, is that we are, when you tie the wealth of a country of the world or a country to any physical resource such as gold, then you're saying that the amount of gold in the world determines how much wealth has been produced. Remember, money is just a means to an end. It was a wonderful replacement of the barter system. Instead of you having to take two cows, a horse, and an animal to be named later, and to go to your neighbor and say, okay, give me your television set, and I'll give you these, you know, these animals instead of the television. Instead of doing that, you just go and give money, because the money becomes this universal conversion factor, and it makes transactions much faster, much easier to perform. It quantifies things instead of having to physically trade physical goods and certain services. So money is just an expression of wealth. It's just a number that's assigned to a certain good or service, so that you can quantify it and measure. It's a wonderful tool. But remember, the actual wealth is it's not how much money I have. It's how much. How many goods and services I can enjoy. That's my wealth. It's not the amount of money. The amount of money is just a number. That's all it is. If I have a television set, I have a smartphone, and I have a car or whatever, that's my wealth. Those physical goods, or if I can go to a spa and get the massage treatment or whatever, that's a service. That's part of my wealth, not the actual number of dollars or cents in my bank account. The money is just a means to an end. And so if you tie money to the gold standard, to gold, you're saying the amount of wealth in the world depends on how much gold would dig up. But no, we're producing television sets, we're producing cars, we're producing all these goods and services in the world. If the let's say the amount of gold in the world ended. Let's say that there's no more gold to mine. That's it. We ran out of more gold. We have all the gold we can possibly have forever and ever. Does that mean that the wealth of the world will stop? No. It's just the fact that we chose gold is such an arbitrary measure. Gold was precious because it was so difficult to find, and it makes sense why it's so valuable. So and represents glory and so many things. It makes sense that gold was valuable, but when we said by law that wealth is the amount of wealth we have depends on how much gold we have, and the whole world has to divide up the wealth based on how much gold has been mined. It's a stupid artificial restriction, and the problem is that because the U.S. remained tied to the gold standard, you could say, through the Great Depression, whereas other countries kind of decoupled from the gold standard, then the U.S. Could not grow its money supply based on the actual economic activity of goods and services being produced, because we were dependent on how much physical gold we had, and that stagnated us. The U.S. and France kind of stuck to the gold standard for throughout the Great Depression, and that's why the Great Depression lasted longer in those two countries than in other places. And just so you know, you could say that the gold standard kind of came back in a kind of veiled way in 1944 with the Bretton Woods Agreement. And what basically what happened there is that the country, several a lot of countries came together and decided, okay, we need to stabilize our economies, because this is part of what led to World War II, with Hitler rising in Germany after Germany had gone through this economic collapse. So they wanted to prevent this sort of thing happening again. And they got together and agreed on, okay, we need to have a system of stable foreign currency exchanges. And they said the currency exchange has to be within 1% of the amount of gold that the country has, or something like that. But instead of gold, they decided that they were going to do like the equivalent of gold, and have a currency that represents the gold. So they initially, John Maynard Keynes, the economist, recommended a world currency that he called the Bancor or something like that. And thank God, no one. The idea was they really were aiming towards going there, but thankfully they never got there, because the U.S. objected, and eventually they agreed, okay, instead of this new currency called the Bancor or whatever, we're going to allow the dollar to be the world's currency. So everything became tied to the dollar. So the U.S. was obligated to have $1 per 35. I'm sorry, $35 per ounce of gold in reserves. And all the countries in the world, they instead of having gold in their vaults, in their bank, central bank vaults, they agreed to have dollars. And that's why the dollar became the world currency. And their currency exchange rates had to be within 1% relative to how many dollars they had in their vault. So the dollar became this the replacement of gold, and the U.S. was they couldn't print more gold, more dollars than gold, but available, because they had to keep the $35 per ounce ratio. So gold became this artificial restrictor, and with the passing of time, that was a great contributor. To the inflation and the big economic woes that the U.S. endured during the 1970s, because what happened is the economies began to roar throughout the world. You know, we had the Asian tigers, you know, Taiwan and Korea and Japan beginning to produce, and Europe recovered from World War II. So the world economies were prospering. So they were demanding more gold. More U.S. dollars than the U.S. dollar the U.S. had to produce or print out. So that meant that because there were not enough U.S. dollars to meet the demand, because we were measuring how much wealth there was in the world by how much gold there was, or how many dollars there were, and we measured how many dollars there had to be by how much gold there was. So the world was tying its wealth to the amount of gold. And and the amount of gold is variable, you know. It has nothing to do with how much the economies of the world are producing. It's just a mineral or a metal or whatever that you mine, and sometimes you find it, sometimes you don't. It had nothing to, has nothing to do with whether the world is really getting wealthier. Because the U.S. was not keeping up with the U.S. dollar was not the amount of U.S. dollars was not keeping up with how much the world economies were growing, then people began to get concerned and started buying gold. And they started demanding gold. And at the same time, Nixon started implementing what they called the Phillips curve mentality, that they thought that by increasing inflation, you promoted employment, because they felt that if you Phillips came up with this curve that seemed to link inflation with unemployment, and they and he kind of said, if you increase inflation gradually, then people will feel the need to go to find employment, and also if prices are rising slowly, then businesses will feel more motivated to sell more, and they will hire more people, and people will want to work because prices are rising, so they need the money. So unemployment will be reduced if you gradually increase inflation. But Nixon got greedy and said, no, we need to pump up the economy real fast. And so he instituted policies that increased inflation, but inflation just was rising too high. And at the same time, people were buying gold. And that combination of two things led to inflation with an economy that was not moving, you know, what they called stagflation. So there was inflation and unemployment, a stagnant economy at the same time. And then on top of that, we had the OPEC crazy boys doing their thing with oil. There were oil shortages, which then increased prices even more, because oil was more expensive and oil was so important in producing the goods and services of all these economies. So all these things combined to cause problems. Thankfully, Nixon, on August 15th, 1971, said enough is enough with the gold stuff, and we're not going to we're going to decouple the dollar from the gold currency. So the U.S. was no longer obligated to maintain that $35 per ounce of gold ratio. But in the short term, that also contributed to inflation, because people became scared and said, because people were not understanding the money supply, and we still don't understand it to this day. So they got concerned with this decoupling, and that also created instability, and inflation rose. So the money supply is very important. The Constitution has to put in factors or things that will keep it stable and prevent all these crazy fluctuations. But in the midst of, so the point in what we were saying about the gold is we have to get away from this crazy notion of the gold standard. The gold standard is implying that the wealth of people depends on how much gold is mined. No, the wealth of people depends on how many television sets you have in your house, how many cars you have in your garage, how many smartphones you can buy. And I'm talking about natural material wealth, obviously, because there's a wealth that's more important than that. But speaking economically, that's how you define your wealth, not by how much gold was mined in some mine in South Africa. That has nothing to do with actual wealth. As we said, if gold ran out, there's no more gold to mine in the world. Does that mean that no more television sets will be produced, no more radios, no more smartphones, no more computers? No. Wealth will continue to grow. And it's ridiculous to tie it to something that has nothing to do with economic activity. Why not unicorns? Or why not four-leaf clovers instead of gold? I mean, why gold in particular? How does that define the wealth of the world? So And the problem is, if you don't let the money supply grow, then you have the short blanket scenario where people can't borrow because there's not enough money available to borrow when it's artificially constrained. So that can also lead to deflation, as happened in the Great Depression. But the thing is that, okay, so the question becomes, how do we control the money supply and what should the Constitution say about it? And the answer basically is maybe something that some people will find shocking, but I believe that this is going to be the solution. And it when it gets written to the Constitution, it will just change the economy in a positive way, I believe, forever. And basically, it boils down to this. When a country produces goods and services, let's say it's a very productive country like the U.S. Up until recently. So the more the economy is producing, then there should be more money to represent the increased wealth. Because money should just be a reflection of how much wealth there is. So when a country, an economy is producing more, the GDP is growing, the money supply should grow. Now, the problem is the governments try to increase the money supply by injecting money into the economy through social programs or through lowering interest rates, which increases the virtual money supply, that M2 money supply of, the virtual money that's out there, but not the real actual currency. So what needs to be done is to be able to increase the economy in a very objective way. So if the GDP, if the production of the country grows by X percent, then that means that the money supply has to grow by X percent as well to keep up with the presence of new goods and services in the economy. So that means we need to put X percent more money into the economy. So how do we do that? We don't want the government spending money because that's crazy Keynesian economics. It doesn't work. It just creates corruption and inefficiency and all sorts of problems. So the best way is to give the money to the banks, but not as money that they own, but money that they can have available to lend. That they can use without eating into their reserves. So in other words, let's say that, just to make it very simple, there are two banks in the whole country, and we need to increase the money supply by $100. Let's say that both banks are equally, that they are twins. They do everything the same size, same loans, same productivity in terms of loans and stuff. So let's say that they're totally equivalent. Then what you do is you give $50 to each, and those $50 go into this special deposit or account that each bank will have. Those $50 will be money that no one owns. The bank doesn't own it. The government doesn't own it. Even the depositors don't own it. It's just there. It's $50 more in this separate bank account. And then you say to the bank, hey, bank, those $50 are there. You can't spend them on anything except on a loan. In other words, you can lend those $50 out. So if someone comes and says, oh, can you give me $50 as a loan, then you can take those $50 from that bank special account and give it to them, and you don't have to worry about reserves or anything. Anything that goes into that special deposit account can be loaned out 100%. So there's technically a 0% reserve. Why? Because the bank doesn't have to hold any reserves for anybody. It's not like you're expecting that at any moment someone will come and claim those $50. Those $50 belong to no one, so the bank has no need to keep a reserve of them. So So the bank will give those $50 in the form of a loan to someone, and that person will then go and use those $50 hopefully to start a business or something like that, and they produce, and then they can pay back the $50 with interest. Yeah, the bank keeps the interest. So we gave, and you say, oh, how, so we're giving the bank free money? No, well, the bank has a job. The bank has been given $50 to manage, and if they make good use of those $50, they deserve their interest because they have to make sure that they give it to someone who will be able to pay them back. So that's where they have to do their own investigating and analyzing whether the guy is a good credit or not and so forth. So they have, they're doing work. So they, you know, a worker is deserving of his wages. So the bank is doing some work with the money you handed to them. So they deserve the interest rates that they can gain from it. But the thing is that those $50 are going out, and while they use those $50, they don't have to touch their reserves. So that increases the amount of money available to lend automatically, and it doesn't automatically trigger inflation because that money is not going directly into people's pockets. It's not like people are getting richer and saying, okay, let's go buy stuff and increase demand and increase prices of everything. No, it's going into this account, and it's going to be sitting there, and then eventually someone will take it out on a loan. And that means that that money is always guaranteed to go into investment, into the establishing of businesses and things like that that will promote the economy in the long term. And that's the way it should be. So that means printing more money. And I believe that should be the physical increase of the money supply. When we say the money supply should grow $100 because in proportion to the GDP, the growth in GDP, then those $100 have to be printed out. Some printing press has to print out those $100, and then they get distributed to the banks. And I believe that the banks should be given the money based on two factors: how big they are, and also how well they distribute, how good they are with the loans they give out. So the larger banks should get a larger share of that pot, because it makes sense. Banks that are more efficient, in other words, their loans are producing profit. They're not giving out bad loans. Those banks should be also be given a higher proportion of the pot. So a way to accomplish those two factors is by taking each bank and multiplying their total deposits, or how big they are, times some sort of efficiency percentage with a maximum of 100%. 100% means that they are giving out loans and everybody's paying back those loans on time with high interest rate and so forth. So there should be some index, and maybe the index can go above or below 100. So that you take that index, multiply it by the total deposits, and that gives you a number for each bank. Then you distribute the pot of new money proportionally based on that product of those two numbers. So you do a proportionate distribution based on that number. So let's say one bank got a number of 1 million and the other bank got a number of 500,000. That means that 2/3 of the pot will go to 1 million, to the 1 million bank, and the other third to the 500,000 bank. So, and that's how the Constitution, I believe, should declare that money should be created and distributed. And then you would see that then there's no Federal Reserve analysis of tinkering with federal target rates and this and that and lowering and increasing, like playing this chess game. It's just a number. And the details of how to calculate that number are still a little bit unclear to me. But I believe that it has to be tied to the GDP, And based on the national GDP, we gross domestic product, we then determine a percentage of growth. And based on that, we say, okay, we have to increase the money supply by X percent. So let's print out that money and then put it in these special deposit accounts for each bank. And the bank, each bank can then use that money and lend it out for free. And there should be some parameters to ensure that these loans are not given out willy-nilly. In other words, if a bank, because they see it as free money, just gives out this loan to some bad, starts giving out bad loans because they have all this free money available, then they should get penalized in some way. So there should be some clear mathematical parameter where if this money is being given out in loans and the loans are not paying off, then the bank will have to pay that back somehow, if you know what I mean. So so some clear parameters have to be added, some minor tinkering details to ensure that that money is used properly. And then the Federal Reserve will not be doing all this game that they do constantly. I believe it's wrong when they are always saying, oh, we need to, Federal Reserve, the central bank should not be trying to have a target of unemployment or inflation or GDP growth. They shouldn't care about all those things. It angers me when I hear the Federal Reserve saying we should do this, that, and the other, so they are trying to control the economy. This all comes from Polio Boy. From FDR, when he started making government bigger and bigger and bigger and doing all this Keynesian economics, that the government has to control the economy with these, as if it were a puppet with these strings. The Federal Reserve should just focus on one thing. The central bank should focus on, okay, making, keeping the money supply consistent with the actual goods and services. And if you let the money supply grow, then we don't no longer have the short blanket syndrome. We don't longer have all these banks wasting all these resources at time and effort, giving money between to each other in overnight loans and all this crazy nonsense. And then people will be free to invest because there's going to be more actual money available instead of it being given so stingily, because the Federal Reserve is stingily letting the money supply grow and only the virtual one, and it's a nightmare. So all of that will end if we institute this simple a rule. There's obviously simple in one way and difficult or complicated in another way, but the basic idea is very simple. You inject money into the banks and these special deposit accounts that are intended for loans only, and that will free up some of the reserves. The banks don't have to worry so much about keeping their balance, their reserves above 10% and so forth, and we will allow the economy to be growing more quickly. And I think that that will allow for the takeoff of the economy in ways that we've not seen in human history. That's how strongly I believe. It's a principle we've all missed for centuries and centuries and centuries. But once we can define, let the money supply grow in an objective way, in accordance with what's happening with the GDP, then things will be very different. And when the economy takes off, and without having to depend on the government doing all this tinkering, we remove all these weapons that the Democrats have, all these excuses that they have to manipulate the economy and socialize it and create the disaster that they are creating. So we need a constitution that protects capitalism by debunking this whole stock market system that we have now, and by changing the way the money supply is controlled, and that will make things much better for everybody. And I know this audio snippet ran very long and it's very convoluted. I hope that it made a little bit of sense. And I hope to see very shortly, or who knows how long, the day when the new American Constitution will have these principles embedded in it. And it will create a level of prosperity and peace that we have never seen before. Thank you very much.